This is the Pearson EdXL International GCSE English as a Second Language Paper 2 Listening Test, June 2022. This test is in four parts, and you will have to answer questions on what you hear. At the end of each extract, there will be a pause to give you time to read the questions. You will hear all four parts twice. Write your answers in the spaces in your question booklet as you listen.
Part 1. Section A. In this section, you will hear five short extracts in which people are talking about the countries they come from. Read the list of countries below, then listen to the extracts. For each question, 1 to 5, identify which country A to H is being described by each speaker by marking a cross for the correct answer. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. Not all countries are described, and each may be used more than once. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now, listen and answer the questions. Speaker 1.
My country is an island, and it is isolated by hundreds of miles from other countries. It has some of the most amazing and unique animals in the world, such as the kangaroo and koala bear. The Great Barrier Reef is one of the country's greatest tourist attractions, and many people enjoy visiting the Sydney Opera House.
Speaker 2. I come from a country which is made up of many islands, whose capital is Tokyo. My country's name means the land of the rising sun. Its culture is very old, but it is a very technologically advanced country, and it has produced mobile phones, cars, televisions, and computers, whose brands are known all over the world. Speaker 3.
I come from the largest country in South America, and most of the population speak Portuguese. The River Amazon flows through my country, and we have more than half of the Amazon rainforest, which is very diverse in both animals and plants. Every year, there is a big carnival held in Rio de Janeiro.
Speaker 4.
My country is the largest country in Asia and has the biggest population in the world. The dragon is a symbol of my country's culture, and it is thought to bring good fortune to its inhabitants. My country is home to the giant panda, which many now call our national treasure. Many tourists come to walk and admire the Great Wall.
Speaker 5.
My country is in South Asia. Its name comes from the River Indus, which is one of the longest in Asia. Apart from Hindi, which is the main language, we have over 22 other languages. It is also home to many endangered species of animals. One of these is the Bengal tiger, which is protected by the state.
Now listen a second time and check your answers. Speaker 1.
My country is an island, and it is isolated by hundreds of miles from other countries. It has some of the most amazing and unique animals in the world, such as the kangaroo and koala bear. The Great Barrier Reef is one of the country's greatest tourist attractions, and many people enjoy visiting the Sydney Opera House.
Speaker 2. I come from a country which is made up of many islands, whose capital is Tokyo. My country's name means the land of the rising sun. Its culture is very old, but it is a very technologically advanced country, and it has produced mobile phones, cars, televisions, and computers, whose brands are known all over the world. Speaker 3.
I come from the largest country in South America, and most of the population speak Portuguese. The River Amazon flows through my country, and we have more than half of the Amazon rainforest, which is very diverse in both animals and plants. Every year, there is a big carnival held in Rio de Janeiro.
Speaker 4.
My country is the largest country in Asia and has the biggest population in the world. The dragon is a symbol of my country's culture, and it is thought to bring good fortune to its inhabitants. My country is home to the giant panda, which many now call our national treasure. Many tourists come to walk and admire the Great Wall.
Speaker 5.
My country is in South Asia. Its name comes from the River Indus, which is one of the longest in Asia. Apart from Hindi, which is the main language, we have over 22 other languages. It is also home to many endangered species of animals. One of these is the Bengal tiger, which is protected by the state.
That's the end of Part 1, Section A. Now turn to Part 1, Section B. Section B. In this section, you will hear someone giving tips on how to learn a foreign language quickly. For questions 6 to 10, listen and answer the questions below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hi there. Do you want to find out how to learn a new language quickly, without the need for expensive classes or language learning software? There are really no secrets or shortcuts. Most importantly, you need to show commitment to your new language. You should also be willing to work hard and not be afraid to make mistakes. Make yourself a weekly timetable to make sure you study every day. If you have too long a break, you are more likely to forget all the grammar and vocabulary that you have learned. You will waste time going back over what you should already know. You can cut down on this lost time by following your timetable. Watch and listen in your chosen language. You can do this by watching television shows or films. Do your best to avoid subtitles, as you will tend to rely on them. To make it easier, watch shows or films you are already familiar with. Listen to songs in that language and learn the words and check what they mean. You should also read in your chosen language. Get a newspaper or a magazine and try to read one article a day, looking up any words you don't understand in a dictionary. The best way to learn a new language is to speak it. Too many people spend a lot of time studying grammar and vocabulary instead of putting what they have learned into practice. Speaking to someone face to face will help you get more motivated about learning the language than staring at a book or a computer screen. Try to find someone who will tutor you or take part in a language exchange scheme. It doesn't matter how basic your skills are. Keep trying to speak, and you will soon notice a big improvement in your vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Hi there. Do you want to find out how to learn a new language quickly, without the need for expensive classes or language learning software? There are really no secrets or shortcuts. Most importantly, you need to show commitment to your new language. You should also be willing to work hard and not be afraid to make mistakes. Make yourself a weekly timetable to make sure you study every day. If you have too long a break, you are more likely to forget all the grammar and vocabulary that you have learned. You will waste time going back over what you should already know. You can cut down on this lost time by following your timetable. Watch and listen in your chosen language. You can do this by watching television shows or films. Do your best to avoid subtitles, as you will tend to rely on them. To make it easier, watch shows or films you are already familiar with. Listen to songs in that language and learn the words and check what they mean. You should also read in your chosen language. Get a newspaper or a magazine and try to read one article a day, looking up any words you don't understand in a dictionary. The best way to learn a new language is to speak it. Too many people spend a lot of time studying grammar and vocabulary instead of putting what they have learned into practice. Speaking to someone face to face will help you get more motivated about learning the language than staring at a book or a computer screen. Try to find someone who will tutor you or take part in a language exchange scheme. It doesn't matter how basic your skills are. Keep trying to speak, and you will soon notice a big improvement in your vocabulary, grammar, and pronunciation.
That's the end of part one. Now turn to part two. Part two. In this part, you will hear a short talk about the future of books. For questions 11 to 18, listen and complete the notes. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. Questions 19 and 20 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Are you a keen book reader? People of all ages are. However, how do you obtain the books that you want to read? Some people borrow them from a local library. Others might buy them from second-hand bookshops. Others will go online. Then there are those readers who love to browse in bookshops and buy the latest editions for their own enjoyment and keep them at home to be read again sometime in the future. Whichever way people like to read their books, the worrying fact is that there were fewer books bought during 2018 than in the previous year. The sale of books fell by some £168 million in value, which is a decline of over 5% in the number of books sold. According to the Publishers Association, which released these figures, this is the first time such a big decline in sales has been recorded for over 4 years. However, the Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Luttinga, who holds the most important position in the Publishers Association, has said that perhaps this is not a bad sign. Audiobooks appear to be increasing in popularity. Sales have rocketed by some 43% over the last year. They still do not match the number of books sold, but this is an optimistic sign that people still want to read books in one form or another. The rise in sales of audiobooks was partly due to a marketing campaign by one of the retail giants who offered a month's free trial of audiobooks and then unlimited downloads for a fixed monthly fee. It is also due, to a large degree, to our busy lifestyles, with more and more people choosing to listen to an audiobook either on their commute to work or while just travelling in their cars. You can access audiobooks anywhere to suit different lifestyles. The rise in the popularity of podcasting is another reason why audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular. More and more book publishers are investing large amounts of money in these digital formats. In fact, the digital book market overall, which includes audiobooks, ebook sales, and subscriptions to various reading devices, showed a very good growth across the year. The Publishers Association noted that while the sale of traditional books declined by nearly 5%, the sale of audiobooks increased by almost the same amount. Traditional book sales are influenced by trends and fashions. The appearance of a popular bestseller or a writer can influence the market hugely. Two of the biggest bestsellers last year in Britain were an autobiography by a former American First Lady and a thriller written by a popular serial writer. This book took on special importance as it was the 25th thriller the author had published, and the increase in sales celebrated this fact. The Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Luttinga, was optimistic about the sales figures for both digital and traditional books. He said that the publishing industry in Britain continues to satisfy an enormous demand for books in all forms. Many publishers are now investing in digital books, and this is paying off. The digital market is growing very quickly, and it is meeting the demands of the readers who want to access books at any time, in any format they choose. That can be traditional or digital. Stephen Luttinga also noted that digital devices have grown in popularity as ever-increasing numbers of people want to enjoy books in a way that suits new technologies and keeps pace with their busy lives. Not only that, digital devices are lightweight and portable. Overall, the book industry is worth billions of pounds to the British economy.
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
Are you a keen book reader? People of all ages are. However, how do you obtain the books that you want to read? Some people borrow them from a local library. Others might buy them from second-hand bookshops. Others will go online. Then there are those readers who love to browse in bookshops and buy the latest editions for their own enjoyment and keep them at home to be read again sometime in the future. Whichever way people like to read their books, The worrying fact is that there were fewer books bought during 2018 than in the previous year. The sale of books fell by some £168 million in value, which is a decline of over 5% in the number of books sold. According to the Publishers Association, which released these figures, this is the first time such a big decline in sales has been recorded for over 4 years. However, the Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Luttinger, who holds the most important position in the Publishers Association, has said that perhaps this is not a bad sign. Audiobooks appear to be increasing in popularity. Sales have rocketed by some 43% over the last year. They still do not match the number of books sold, but this is an optimistic sign that people still want to read books in one form or another. The rise in sales of audiobooks was partly due to a marketing campaign by one of the retail giants who offered a month's free trial of audiobooks and then unlimited downloads for a fixed monthly fee. It is also due, to a large degree, to our busy lifestyles, with more and more people choosing to listen to an audiobook either on their commute to work or while just travelling in their cars. You can access audiobooks anywhere to suit different lifestyles. The rise in the popularity of podcasting is another reason why audiobooks are becoming increasingly popular. More and more book publishers are investing large amounts of money in these digital formats. In fact, the digital book market overall, which includes audiobooks, ebook sales, and subscriptions to various reading devices, showed a very good growth across the year. The Publishers Association noted that while the sale of traditional books declined by nearly 5%, the sale of audiobooks increased by almost the same amount. Traditional book sales are influenced by trends and fashions. The appearance of a popular bestseller or a writer can influence the market hugely. Two of the biggest bestsellers last year in Britain were an autobiography by a former American First Lady and a thriller written by a popular serial writer. This book took on special importance as it was the 25th thriller the author had published, and the increase in sales celebrated this fact. The Chief Executive Officer, Stephen Luttinger, was optimistic about the sales figures for both digital and traditional books. He said that the publishing industry in Britain continues to satisfy an enormous demand for books in all forms. Many publishers are now investing in digital books, and this is paying off. The digital market is growing very quickly, and it is meeting the demands of the readers who want to access books at any time, in any format they choose. That can be traditional or digital. Stephen Luttinger also noted that digital devices have grown in popularity as ever-increasing numbers of people want to enjoy books in a way that suits new technologies and keeps pace with their busy lives. Not only that, digital devices are lightweight and portable. Overall, the book industry is worth billions of pounds to the British economy.
That's the end of part two. Now turn to part three. Part three. In this part, you will hear an interview with a magazine editor who has just written a book about motorcycles. For questions 21 to 25, listen and answer the questions. You do not need to write in full sentences. Questions 26 to 30 must be answered with a cross in a box. If you change your mind about an answer, put a line through the box and then mark your new answer with a cross. One mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
Hello and welcome to our programme. I would like to introduce you to Hugo Wilson. Some of you will know him as the editor of a well-written and beautifully designed monthly magazine dedicated to motorcycling. When not working as an editor, he rides a vintage Italian motorcycle, which shows he is a man of excellent taste.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today's programme.
You're welcome. I would like to tell our listeners about a book that you've just written about famous motorcycles, dating back from the 1920s right up to the latest super motorcycle. Can you tell us a little about this book?
Well, there are over 300 motorcycles featured, all of them different and all of them amazing in their own way. The only common thing with the machines is they have an engine and two wheels.
Motorcycles have always been much more than just a means of transport, haven't they? Or am I wrong in thinking that?
You're right. Ever since they were invented, motorcycles have caught the imagination of not only men and boys, but also women and girls. It's probably to do with escape, excitement, and technology, as well as the combination of the motorcycle's physical form and the cultural meaning that they have acquired over 100 years.
Could you explain that to our listeners?
Yes, of course. Throughout the history of the motorcycle, there has been a common quest from both riders and engineers, and that is performance. This is not just about power and speed, but ease of handling, safety, and comfort.
Yes, that may be, but surely motorcycle buyers have an interest in good looks. Personally, I can't see the point of having a high-performance motorcycle if it's unattractive. Some just want a cheaper motorcycle to run, but unless I am mistaken, this has never really been a priority for anyone interested in chasing motorcycle mates on a racing track.
You're right. Racing and competition have always been behind the development of the machines. From the moment when the first two pioneer riders met on a dusty road and began boasting about their machines, there has been motorcycle racing. The result of competition has been technological leaps, driven by the needs for racing success. Sometimes the developments have been small, sometimes huge. In our century, advances in electronics have made engines cleaner, more economical, more powerful, and more user-friendly.
And I presume these improvements have had an impact on sporting motorcycles, even on the simplest mopeds. And what about manufacturers? Are they keeping up with all the changes?
Well, some manufacturers are not changing fast enough. Owners love to work on their motorcycles, try to improve their performance, and often change their looks, whether for cosmetic or functional reasons. In my opinion, there are few motorcyclists who can resist customizing their motorcycles, even in a small way.
I have read that some of the early motorcyclists built their own machines. In the early years of the 20th century, it was quite easy to become a motorcycle manufacturer. You just assembled some ready-made components, put a unique name on the fuel tank, and you had your motorcycle. It's not that easy nowadays, is it?
No, it isn't easy. Today, you need a unique idea to justify the development process and the huge cost necessary to produce even a few motorcycles with your name or brand on the tank.
But some people still have drive and dedication, not to mention financial backing. And new names will appear from time to time, isn't that true?
Well, yes. Just look at John Britton, who built an amazing motorcycle about 20 years ago. The motorcycle named after him was both functional and beautiful. It's tragic that only 11 of these magnificent machines were ever built.
So, in your opinion, What is the most important thing people look for when buying a motorcycle?
Well, I think that performance is not the most important factor. The look of a motorcycle and what that says about the buyer is very important. People have always been concerned about what their choice of motorcycle says about them.
I think you're right there. The popularity of the motorcycle has been influenced by their image in films like Easy Rider or the famous scene from The Great Escape. These were not real racing motorcycles, but have influenced our ideas about why we would want one and how we would like it to look. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You're right. Since I started writing about motorcycles and have published books on how to maintain one, manufacturers have built faster and more powerful motorcycles, as well as slower, more economical ones that are no less attractive in looks and customer appeal. Some brands have flourished while others have declined and disappeared altogether. For example, one of the oldest brands has survived thanks to the Indian Army, who in 1967 bought the factory and moved production to India.
I think we can safely say that the motorcycle is constantly evolving, with new technology, new designs, and new styles. Thanks, Hugo, for talking to us.
Yes, every rider has a different idea of what makes the perfect motorcycle. I, too, have my own dream machine, as I'm sure your listeners do. Thanks for having me on your programme.
It's been a pleasure.
Now, listen a second time and check your answers.
Hello and welcome to our programme. I would like to introduce you to Hugo Wilson. Some of you will know him as the editor of a well-written and beautifully designed monthly magazine dedicated to motorcycling. When not working as an editor, he rides a vintage Italian motorcycle, which shows he is a man of excellent taste.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me on today's programme.
You're welcome. I would like to tell our listeners about a book that you've just written about famous motorcycles, dating back from the 1920s right up to the latest super motorcycle. Can you tell us a little about this book?
Well, there are over 300 motorcycles featured, all of them different and all of them amazing in their own way. The only common thing with the machines is they have an engine and two wheels.
Motorcycles have always been much more than just a means of transport, haven't they? Or am I wrong in thinking that?
You're right. Ever since they were invented, motorcycles have caught the imagination of not only men and boys, but also women and girls. It's probably to do with escape, excitement, and technology, as well as the combination of the motorcycle's physical form and the cultural meaning that they have acquired over 100 years.
Could you explain that to our listeners?
Yes, of course. Throughout the history of the motorcycle, there has been a common quest from both riders and engineers, and that is performance. This is not just about power and speed, but ease of handling, safety, and comfort.
Yes, that may be, but surely motorcycle buyers have an interest in good looks. Personally, I can't see the point of having a high-performance motorcycle if it's unattractive. Some just want a cheaper motorcycle to run, but unless I am mistaken, this has never really been a priority for anyone interested in chasing motorcycle mates on a racing track.
You're right. Racing and competition have always been behind the development of the machines. From the moment when the first two pioneer riders met on a dusty road and began boasting about their machines, there has been motorcycle racing. The result of competition has been technological leaps, driven by the needs for racing success. Sometimes the developments have been small, sometimes huge. In our century, advances in electronics have made engines cleaner, more economical, more powerful, and more user-friendly.
And I presume these improvements have had an impact on sporting motorcycles, even on the simplest mopeds. And what about manufacturers? Are they keeping up with all the changes?
Well, some manufacturers are not changing fast enough. Owners love to work on their motorcycles, try to improve their performance, and often change their looks, whether for cosmetic or functional reasons. In my opinion, there are few motorcyclists who can resist customizing their motorcycles, even in a small way.
I have read that some of the early motorcyclists built their own machines. In the early years of the 20th century, it was quite easy to become a motorcycle manufacturer. You just assembled some ready-made components, put a unique name on the fuel tank, and you had your motorcycle. It's not that easy nowadays, is it?
No, it isn't easy. Today, you need a unique idea to justify the development process and the huge cost necessary to produce even a few motorcycles with your name or brand on the tank.
But some people still have drive and dedication, not to mention financial backing. And new names will appear from time to time, isn't that true?
Well, yes. Just look at John Britton, who built an amazing motorcycle about 20 years ago. The motorcycle named after him was both functional and beautiful. It's tragic that only 11 of these magnificent machines were ever built.
So, in your opinion, what is the most important thing people look for when buying a motorcycle?
Well, I think that performance is not the most important factor. The look of a motorcycle and what that says about the buyer is very important. People have always been concerned about what their choice of motorcycle says about them.
I think you're right there. The popularity of the motorcycle has been influenced by their image in films like Easy Rider or the famous scene from The Great Escape. These were not real racing motorcycles, but have influenced our ideas about why we would want one and how we would like it to look. Correct me if I'm wrong.
You're right. Since I started writing about motorcycles and have published books on how to maintain one, manufacturers have built faster and more powerful motorcycles, as well as slower, more economical ones, that are no less attractive in looks and customer appeal. Some brands have flourished while others have declined and disappeared altogether. For example, one of the oldest brands has survived thanks to the Indian Army, who in 1967 bought the factory and moved production to India.
I think we can safely say that the motorcycle is constantly evolving, with new technology, new designs, and new styles. Thanks, Hugo, for talking to us.
Yes, every rider has a different idea of what makes the perfect motorcycle. I, too, have my own dream machine, as I'm sure your listeners do. Thanks for having me on your program.
It's been a pleasure.
That's the end of part 3. Now turn to part 4. Part 4. In this part, you will hear a podcast by a scientist talking about her work. For questions 31 to 33 and 38 to 40, listen and complete the sentences below. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. For questions 34 to 37, complete the table. Write no more than 3 words for each answer. 1 mark will be awarded for each correct answer. You have 1 minute to read the questions. Now listen and answer the questions.
The National Geographic Explorers Festival is held every year in Washington, D.C. Scientists and explorers discuss their successes. They network with each other and share concerns about our planet that needs people like them to save it. One of the youngest speakers to take part this year was Emma Camp, a marine scientist. She has just finished a 2-year study of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Here is Emma talking about the challenges facing the Great Barrier Reef.
The Great Barrier Reef in Australia is home to over 7,000 marine species. It has huge economic and cultural value and supports eco-services such as fishing. This underwater city, made up mostly of coral and full of life and colour, is turning white and derelict. Warmer, more acidic and low oxygen water is so badly affecting the coral that we don't know if coral will exist in the future. Within 3 years, we have lost a third of the Great Barrier Reef. Climate change is affecting reefs globally. Coral are living organisms related to jellyfish. Their survival relies on tiny seaweed or algae which live in them, and this is what gives the coral their red colour. Under stress, such as warmer, more acidic water with less oxygen, the algae will leave the coral. However, in my research, I have discovered that there are certain types of coral that exist and thrive in the kind of warm, higher acidic water we are beginning to see all over the world. I have started a project of transplanting some of these super survivor coral to reefs that are being damaged by rising sea temperatures. My project aims to find out how they survive and whether they could help other reefs. With my team, we have already set up a multi-species coral nursery off the coast of Australia. These nurseries consist of mesh fences with cuttings of different types of coral attached to them, and they are weighed down as close to the seafloor as possible. However, all this requires further international funding and support, and it may not even work. The Great Barrier Reef is huge. It is approximately the size of Italy and subject to different stresses like those I mentioned earlier. However, I really hope it does work. We are talking about one of the wonders of the natural world, visible from outer space and worth millions of pounds in tourism each year. It deserves to be given a chance. We need to be cautious and not too optimistic about our project, in case skeptics use this as an example of us underestimating the planet's ability to survive whatever the conditions. Some people will look for an excuse to do less, so we need to be honest and not give a false sense of security. It is important we lower carbon emissions to save coral reefs. That's our number one priority, I think. But we must also look at alternative strategies we can use in addition to that. For me, it's about raising awareness of what's going on in our oceans. So really, it's more about exposure than money. These are global issues, and we need to get multinational companies and sponsors involved. I have been fortunate in having been promised funding and support for my project, although it did not win first prize at the festival. People often ask how I got interested in this rather specialised field of study. I went on a snorkelling holiday with my family to the Bahamas when I was just 7. I vividly remember putting on a mask and for the first time seeing this whole world teeming with life you couldn't see from above water, this complex coral network. At the time, I just appreciated its beauty, but as I got older, I started to understand how important that ecosystem is. So many humans and creatures rely on it. They all interact with the reef. The best case scenario is that in 50 years' time, we will have thriving coral reefs serving their function. We will have an even healthier marine environment than we do now, which respects biodiversity. The worst case scenario is that we've lost coral reefs as we know them. I don't want to tell my future grandchildren that this was a privilege I had, but they won't have, because we didn't do enough when we had the chance. We must not give up trying. Let's be the individuals who make it their commitment in life to do everything they can to protect the reefs. I am optimistic about the future, but I am aware that the planet is now at a crossroads. Thank you for listening.
Although Emma's project narrowly missed out on being one of the 5 prize winners, or laureates, the judges were so impressed that she was made an associate laureate, which means that her project will receive funding. Last year, she was also announced as one of the 17 young leaders for the Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations. It's a 2-year position, and she has already addressed the United Nations General Assembly. Her opening words were, "We, the young, are the next custodians who will inherit the planet and pass it on to our children. And there's a real commitment to make sure young people's voices are heard."
Now listen a second time and check your answers.
The National Geographic Explorers Festival is held every year in Washington, D.C. Scientists and explorers discuss their successes. They network with each other and share concerns about our planet that needs people like them to save it. One of the youngest speakers to take part this year was Emma Camp, a marine scientist. She has just finished a 2-year study of the Great Barrier Reef in Australia. Here is Emma talking about the challenges facing the Great Barrier Reef.
The Great Barrier Reef in Australia is home to over 7,000 marine species. It has huge economic and cultural value and supports eco-services such as fishing. This underwater city, made up mostly of coral and full of life and colour, is turning white and derelict. Warmer, more acidic and low oxygen water is so badly affecting the coral that we don't know if coral will exist in the future. Within 3 years, we have lost a third of the Great Barrier Reef. Climate change is affecting reefs globally. Coral are living organisms related to jellyfish. Their survival relies on tiny seaweed, or algae, which live in them, and this is what gives the coral their red colour. Under stress, such as warmer, more acidic water with less oxygen, the algae will leave the coral. However, in my research, I have discovered that there are certain types of coral that exist and thrive in the kind of warm, higher acidic water we are beginning to see all over the world. I have started a project of transplanting some of these super survivor coral to reefs that are being damaged by rising sea temperatures. My project aims to find out how they survive and whether they could help other reefs. With my team, we have already set up a multi-species coral nursery off the coast of Australia. These nurseries consist of mesh fences with cuttings of different types of coral attached to them, and they are weighed down as close to the seafloor as possible. However, all this requires further international funding and support, and it may not even work. The Great Barrier Reef is huge. It is approximately the size of Italy and subject to different stresses like those I mentioned earlier. However, I really hope it does work. We are talking about one of the wonders of the natural world, visible from outer space and worth millions of pounds in tourism each year. It deserves to be given a chance. We need to be cautious and not too optimistic about our project, in case skeptics use this as an example of us underestimating the planet's ability to survive whatever the conditions. Some people will look for an excuse to do less, so we need to be honest and not give a false sense of security. It is important we lower carbon emissions to save coral reefs. That's our number one priority, I think. But we must also look at alternative strategies we can use in addition to that. For me, it's about raising awareness of what's going on in our oceans. So really, it's more about exposure than money. These are global issues, and we need to get multinational companies and sponsors involved. I have been fortunate in having been promised funding and support for my project, although it did not win first prize at the festival. People often ask how I got interested in this rather specialised field of study. I went on a snorkeling holiday with my family to the Bahamas when I was just 7. I vividly remember putting on a mask and for the first time seeing this whole world teeming with life you couldn't see from above water, this complex coral network. At the time, I just appreciated its beauty, but as I got older, I started to understand how important that ecosystem is. So many humans and creatures rely on it. They all interact with the reef. The best case scenario is that in 50 years' time, we will have thriving coral reefs serving their function. We will have an even healthier marine environment than we do now, which respects biodiversity. The worst case scenario is that we've lost coral reefs as we know them. I don't want to tell my future grandchildren that this was a privilege I had, but they won't have, because we didn't do enough when we had the chance. We must not give up trying. Let's be the individuals who make it their commitment in life to do everything they can to protect the reefs. I am optimistic about the future, but I am aware that the planet is now at a crossroads. Thank you for listening.
Although Emma's project narrowly missed out on being one of the 5 prize winners, or laureates, the judges were so impressed that she was made an associate laureate, which means that her project will receive funding. Last year, she was also announced as one of the 17 young leaders for the Sustainable Development Goals by the United Nations. It's a 2-year position, and she has already addressed the United Nations General Assembly. Her opening words were, "We, the young, are the next custodians who will inherit the planet and pass it on to our children. And there's a real commitment to make sure young people's voices are heard."
That is the end of the test. Please wait for your question booklet to be collected. Thank you, and good luck.